this contract undermines our obligation to balance the budget and to ensure that our policing is constitutional. And I believe that the public has a right to explore this legislation more carefully.
There's some things that we can't say legally, but I can say that this is an agreement to bridge the gap as we continue negotiations with this contract.
What you're hearing there, some of the discussion from the Seattle City Council this week regarding a new contract for the Seattle Police Officers Guild. The Union for Rank and File Officers of the SPD. Has this contract gone through the right amount of scrutiny? Does it need a public hearing? Also, what is a financial audit, really? A moment of self-reflection on an impending budget update this week? Plus, who's pushing back on the mayor's proposed update to Seattle's comprehensive plan, our city's roadmap to urban growth? Well, we are looking at these questions and so much more this week on Seattle News, Views, and Brews, your coffee break political podcast. I'm Brian Callanan. I am a host on Seattle Channel. The views expressed here are mine. And I'm with my co-host, David Croman, the City Hall reporter for the Seattle Times. And David, I'll make sure to bring you in here. And I guess I got to ask the question this way. Were you one of the lucky ones who saw the Northern Lights last Friday night? Or were you a doofus like me and said, nah, I'll just get to bed early. I'll make sure I see him on Saturday and be completely disappointed. What camp are you in there?
Well, I was in Portland and I was in the middle of the city and also have a toddler, and so I admit that I did not see them. I have seen them elsewhere a couple times, okay. And it's always an amazing thing. So I'm sad I missed them, and also it is a bucket list item that I have checked, so I don't feel totally disheartened. Okay.
Yeah, well, and we'll make sure you remind your kid in 20 years. That's going to be an important thing, yeah. Because my kid was at home, like went out our front door, took the photo, and didn't even wake us up. So that's a whole nother show there. David, thank you, as always, for joining me here. Thanks also to City Grind Espresso, our background noise sponsor, for the audio podcast. They are on the first floor of City Hall. And a special thanks to the patrons who keep the show going, like Stephen. Thank you for your support, Stephen. Become a patron, folks. You'll get access to patrons first content before anybody else. We'll answer your questions about City Hall and the show, too, a special bonus there. Check it out on Patreon, Seattle News, Views, and Brews. A big thanks also to Converge Media. The video version of this podcast is on Converge Wednesday nights at 7. All right, it's time for Right Here, Right Now. Okay, folks, another current events check-in. Police hiring legislation looks like it's going to go through next week with the full council. That delivery driver wages legislation the week after that on the 28th this week. The council is approving that measure we talked about a few weeks ago, allowing the fire department to condemn vacant buildings more quickly. Plus, the SPD is getting automated license plate readers in all of its cars to deter vehicle theft. And we're about to see the appointment of Don Lindell as the next CEO of City Light. We'll keep post on those. But the big, big story this week, the council's approval of this new, slightly odd, I got to put it that way, contract for SPOG, the Police Officers Guild. As we've told you before, this is retroactive. Only talks about raises through the end of 2023. It does make SPD officers the highest paid in the state. But as we have noted, it still has some question marks around accountability, which is what Councilmember Morales was so concerned about. She was calling for a public hearing. That's not going to happen. The council rejected her motion to take this item off the agenda for this vote, 8-1, then approved the contract by that same margin, 8-1. David, I just wanted to go down this path briefly, if I could. Why isn't there a public hearing on this? I know Councilmember Morales was the lone vote calling for this, but why isn't there a public hearing for this? What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, there hasn't been, you know, if you look at the last time the contract came up, there wasn't a formal public hearing then either. You know, there have been some community forums. The Community
Yes.
Police Commission has hosted them. But, and you know, I don't know the full historical record, but I know at least at the last SPOG contract, there wasn't a city council hearing. So it would be a little out of the ordinary to have one. Also, I think really what's going on is the city council is not really in a position. I mean, voting up or down on a contract is a really odd thing because it's not like mm-hmm. a piece of legislation that you can approve. And when it shows up at the full council, it's basically already had a majority of the council vote to approve it in the secretive labor relations committee that five of them are members of. Mm-hmm. And so for it to go from the labor relations committee to the full council and then be voted down, there are some legal implications there, and certainly would open the city to a unfair labor practice. I mean, if you truly feel strongly that this contract is wrong and should be voted, you know, that still an option. It just is more complicated than voting down a piece of legislation. All of which to say, you know, we know that this council has had decided they were going to vote for it, and literally nothing was going to change their mind. And so I think they felt that, why are we hosting a public comment on something that is not going to change? On the flip side, you know, this is a really important contract for a lot of reasons. And, you know, even the people who voted for it acknowledged that there are likely shortcomings and, you know, there are pieces of it that a federal judge, I'm almost positive, is going to take at least some issue with. And so, you know, I think that's Councilmember Morales's point, is there's a lot to talk about here and we should give the public an opportunity to talk about it.
Yeah. And I should point out as well, you mentioned that Labor Committee. That was part of the memo that the council was looking at today. The Labor Committee didn't plan to hold another public hearing, as the memo says, because the proposed interim agreement has not changed the city's overall negotiation goals. I think we heard that from the council as well on Tuesday afternoon, this idea that this is not a perfect contract. The goals are still in place to build another contract, which they're going to have to do, because here we are in 2024. There isn't a contract that really covers this year and beyond. And I think we heard from a lot of council members, they didn't flat out reject what Councilmember Morales had to say, but they were very limited about what they could say with regard to these negotiations under state law. It's this whole idea that we don't have a full understanding of the process involved with these negotiations. You touched on this earlier, and I just wanted to go with you a little bit further on that. It just seems like a very frustrating place for the council to be in. I think they want to talk about some of these negotiations, but legally they're not able to do that. And that's a big challenge.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and it's the same one that the last city council, I mean, the last city council was considerably more kind of progressive left wing than this one. And they also voted 8-1 in favor of the contract for many of the same reasons, which is, you know, it's just a lot hairier than voting on a piece of legislation. And I mean, I think they'd like to kind of pull back the cover on exactly the discussions that were happening, but it's just not how this process works. It's, which is just very interesting, because I find this whole, the dynamic between Seattle or just police unions and the rest of the labor world really interesting, because, you know, it's mostly progressives and left, you know, on the left wing kind of arguing for, to slow this process down and to open up the bargaining a little bit and to change, you know, the, taking issue with this process. At the same time, it's, you know, the sort of historically left wing labor community that in a lot of ways is protecting this right that the police officers get has. And, you know, I think it's why, for example, accountability is still something that the city negotiates at all, despite some of their frustration, because, you know, the state legislature would have to step in and change the parameters of the collective bargaining to strip out accountability. But the left, you know, the labor community hates that precedent, even if it's even if they're a little uneasy with the relationship with some police unions. The labor community is not going to support laws that would strip back collective bargaining rights at all. And so it's just this super interesting dynamic that leaves it kind of a secretive and opaque process still.
Yeah, it really is. And that what you're saying there about the state needing to step in here, that's exactly what the federal monitor said in this case. The judge who's overseeing this federal consent decree and thinking about those accountability concerns, the quote was, "The only true solution to this challenge would be for the state legislature to act and prohibit accountability-related issues from being part of police collective bargaining." Wow, there's a lot to this one. I know there's a lot more than just this meeting today, but David, I appreciate you talking about that. And I do want to make sure that we move on to some other pieces of the show here, if we could, because I saw you post earlier this week about this, about the work the Select Budget Committee is undertaking this week. And there's the chair of the Budget Committee, Councilmember Strauss, trying to defend his take that he's performing a, quote, audit of the budget, which he's really not. And a few people gave him a tough time about that. What the heck was going on there? That was such a, you noted, it was a very Seattle moment. What was happening there?
Yeah, I mean, this is not an audit that the city has done. It's a review of the budget. And they basically, you know, because an audit ends with recommendations and it's looking for weaknesses and it's a really sort of formal process. What Councilmember Strauss's office and the council central staff had undertaken was basically a kind of in-depth review. I mean, you know, it would be difficult to perform an audit as just an individual. If you were an individual, you theoretically could have gone in and sort of found all this stuff. The central staff just kind of pulled it all together in one really comprehensive report. But I think because a lot of the council members on the campaign trail kept talking about wanting to audit the budget, so on and so forth, Councilmember Strauss really got this idea in his head of, you know, the Merriam-Webster's definition of an audit is, you know, this is, and so, you know, it just became this like sort of, frankly, silly fight yes. over whether or not what the city council had done was in fact an audit. It's clearly not yeah. an audit, but like, that's not to say it's not a valuable exercise. I mean, I learned a lot from that report. It's just, yeah. it's not an audit.
Right. Fair. I did want to get back to the here and now, because the budget committee will be looking at this this week, getting an update on budget numbers. And the number we're all focused on, the budget deficit, appears to continue to be going up here. What was a $241 million deficit as of a few months ago is now $258 million, it looks like, in 2025. I know that this could potentially increase in terms of settled labor contract costs. The report points to that. Also looking at higher inflation, that's definitely a factor in this as well. I guess I'm seeing this growing budget cap here, budget gap, I should say. And I just kind of want to put the question, do you see a bleaker budget situation in the weeks and months ahead? I know the council started on this early, and they're really going to be looking at this throughout the summer into the fall, long before they'd usually start this in September.
Yeah, I mean, the mayor's office will say it always called this a $250 million budget deficit, even when it wasn't yet that big, because they anticipated that that's what it would become through some combination yeah. of new labor agreements. You know, this appears more to be about sort of revised. It seems like there's a lot that went into this. It seems to be more about like revisions about how much was spent, how much wasn't spent, revenues, you know, just kind of a recalculation more so, I think, than new labor agreements. Because despite what I would have guessed, it seems like the city had actually put away most of what it needed in reserves to cover the new police contract, which frankly mm-hmm. is surprising to me. I mean, it goes a little bit yeah. over, but it doesn't enormously add to the budget.
Right.
But, you know, I think the picture is not totally out of what the city was expecting, but it's, you know, close to $260 million now. So
yeah.
that's, of course, worse than $230 million. I mean,
yeah.
so, yeah, it's not, certainly not good news.
Yeah, and I know we're going to be hearing a little bit more in August about some revised numbers, too. But you can bet that this meeting this week for the Select Committee on the Budget is going to be raising some eyebrows there and seeing those numbers increase and trying to look for some different ways to solve this issue, which is going to be the big, big job over the next couple of months. All right, David, we do need to move on here. I want to talk about something that I found very interesting here. A number of people pushing back and asking for more out of the mayor's proposed comprehensive plan. And these may not be the people you might think. Stay tuned for more details on Now Hear This. Well, we have a new twist in the saga of the comprehensive plan as proposed by Mayor Bruce Harrell, the roadmap for growth in the city of Seattle over the next 20 years. There's a group called the Complete Communities Coalition, including the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber, Habitat for Humanity, social housing advocates, commercial developers too. This group sent a letter to the city calling for much more density to be added to the mayor's plan. The mayor has been talking a lot about adding affordable housing over the last couple of months. Here's a clip of what he was saying about the city's accomplishments when it comes to affordable housing back in February. But there's a push for much more.
Last year, we over 14,000 homes across 13 buildings opened in affordable rental housing across Seattle. And again, creativity, innovation, forward thinking on how we're going to achieve this. And thanks to the recently approved housing levy, we'll be able to invest more than 3,000 new affordable homes for our most vulnerable neighbors over the next 7 years, as well as provide greater support for the staff and the operation of affordable housing buildings.
David, I was just really struck by this broad coalition of very different constituencies and what they were saying, to quote from this letter they actually sent to the mayor's office. Simply put, the current draft plan is a plan to make Seattle more expensive. This will most impact renters, low-income people, and people of color as we face rising rents and displacement pressures. What do you make of this group? There are some people that don't normally work together that are definitely working together here, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I think there's, urbanism and urban planning, you know, in the same way that, like, you could say that kind of NIMBYism transcends politics. It's not really a Republican thing or a Democratic thing. Just, mm-hmm. I think on the flip side, advocacy for more density and more housing also sort of transcends politics, you know?
Right.
So you, on this list, you have some organizations that have pushed for defunding the police, for example, and then
right.
the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce or Zillow or something. But I do think that kind of goes to show that when you're talking about housing, what you think of as the political camps kind of get smudged a little bit. Mm-hmm. Frankly, why I find it pretty interesting is, yeah, you end up with some interesting alliances. You know, we'd see this sometimes on the other side, sort of skeptics of more density, you know, Councilmember Shama Sawant and Alex Peterson taking votes sure. together.
for example.
Or, and then on this side, you know, you've got business advocacy organizations with basically activist organizations. So it's surprising on its surface. If you've been kind of following the housing debate, it's actually not that surprising. No organization on here was taking a new position from what I know about them before.
Yeah, fair. And I know we've heard a lot more about some state legislators pushing back on this as well. So a rising chorus, I guess, of voices that are pushing back here. And I should point out, folks, if you have some concerns about the comprehensive plan, there's actually a deadline that has been extended to May 20th. If you want to put in some public comments about it, talk to your city council member if you want to get some more information about this or make your two cents heard on this one. I did want to talk, David, about what this coalition is calling for here. There's a list of half a dozen things. They're talking about allowing for larger fourplexes and sixplexes, allowing mid-rise construction and mixed-use apartment commercial buildings within a five-minute walk of bus lines instead of just along the arterial streets near the frequent transit, which is what the mayor's talking about. They also want to expand these neighborhood centers from an 800-foot radius to a quarter mile. This is a new designation in the plan, and this is going to be very interesting. It would allow for 4 to 6-story apartments in there. Also, fourth on the list here, more density bonuses. This was interesting. A lot like the plan the council just rejected from Councilmember Morales, the Connected Communities legislation. And then we're talking also about the coalition calling on the city to allow for 12 to 18-story buildings in all of the regional centers that are on this list, including Capitol Hill, the U District, Northgate, Ballard. So a lot going on here. And I just wanted to ask your opinion on this. What do you make of this list? I think this is some of the things that some of the different density advocates have been pushing for here. Anything jump out at you with this list of, I won't say demands, but the things that they're looking for?
Yeah, advocacy for more, the mid-rise buildings, you know, I mean, because there's just questions about, you know, in a lot of places, maybe technically the comprehensive plan would allow for 6 units, but there's some questions about like cost benefit of that or whether, you know, people could make it pencil. And so I think this is pushing for going beyond sort of nibbling at the edges and pushing for what could be some noticeable change in certain neighborhoods, but in a way that this coalition argues will drive down housing costs.
Yeah, that's the key here, because along with the density and the added amount of housing, you've got to make something that's affordable for people too. So yeah, I'm interested to see what happens next there, but I did want to move on to our next story if I could with you. And this was a piece you covered last week, David. I wanted to follow up on this announcement that the city of Seattle is going to open a post-overdose recovery center downtown. The Downtown Emergency Service Center will open this space in 2025 as planned right now at the Morrison Hotel near Pioneer Square. So emergency responders would offer to take people there after they've overdosed and been revived with Narcan. The mayor himself pointed out, David, this public health space is not a place where the city usually operates, but here we are. What does that say to you, that the city is taking more of an active role here where normally I think we'd see the county or the state involved?
It's an interesting idea. I hadn't really ever heard of these facilities before. I know if they exist elsewhere. You know, talking to some fire department folks afterwards, you know, their take was basically, you know, you pick people up and they often really don't want to go to the hospital. I mean, for obvious reasons, who wants to go to the hospital? But they may not have somewhere else to go. If you don't take them to a shelter, they're going to be out on the street. If they're out on the street, you know, the key point here too is like when somebody overdoses and receives a dose of Narcan, it, you know, blasts all opioids off receptors of their brain and, you know, revives them. That also triggers a pretty harsh withdrawal. And so a lot of times people will overdose, get a dose of Narcan, maybe from a fire official, don't have anywhere to take them. They kind of go back out on the street, and then, of course, they're going to look as quickly as they can for another dose ease the withdrawal symptoms. So the hope with this facility is, instead of that sort of in-between where they don't want to go to a hospital, they don't want to go on the streets, you offer them a place kind of interim where they can go, and then there's medicine there for them that's not a deadly dose of fentanyl that could kind of help stabilize their withdrawal symptoms. You're right. I mean, it's not an area that the city is usually super closely involved in. And, you know, this is not just a city-led effort. There's money from federal grant money, and there's county money, and there's UW money, and private money. So, but, yeah, I mean, I think it's a reflection of probably what the city's been hearing from particularly firefighters and fire department officials, which is, you know, if we had a kind of third option that's not hospital or shelter or the street, so I guess a fourth option, to take people where they could recover and kind of get back on their feet, then that might do a lot of good. And so that's the hope here. The big question is what comes. Big question is what comes after. Because people can't sleep there 23 hours, and you know they acknowledge that there isn't a great answer to that yet. But you know, the hope is at least in the interim, maybe you save a few lives from people who don't go out and see fentanyl again right away.
Right. So a 23-hour facility, as I understand it. I just had a logistics kind of question about this in terms of how people would end up there. They're not going to be forced there, as I understand it. So I'm just trying to figure out what it looks like. A firefighter or EMT would revive someone and offer to bring them there. Would police ever bring people to this location? I keep thinking about our drug possession laws that are on the books now and how police are going to be interacting with people who potentially are overdosing and what that looks like. Can you help me with the pathway to get to a facility like this? What is that going to look like?
Yeah, I think police could theoretically, I mean, there's because, you know, there are crisis responders, you know, police who are kind of trained specifically focused on crisis response. And so, yes, they might, you know, that raises a lot of questions around whether, you know, somebody who's using illegal drugs and, you know, that is illegal again under the new drug ordinance would want to get in the back of a police car. I don't know. So I think, I think for that reason, the fire department is the most likely to be the transport agency. Yeah. I had that question too, is, you know, are people going to agree to this? The people at this event, the firefighters seem to think yes. Cause again, they're hearing from folks and they're offering a rides and most people are kind of don't have a lot of good options of where they want to go. So,
yeah,
you know, I think they were saying that they thought they could maybe treat up to 20, 25 people in a day, you know, in a 24-hour period. That's quite a few. Also a depressing statistic that there are that many people who might be overdosing and receiving Narcan. But so, yeah, that's the question for me is because, yeah, no, it's not an arrest. You can't force people to go there. But the impression I got is the belief is people will want to go here.
Yeah, that's the big key from the DESC to try to create an option that is a better option than the street for people who are dealing with the challenges of addiction there. So this is something we'll see play out next year as this facility opens up. Looking forward to seeing what the DESC has in mind for this facility in terms of growing it. Well, coming up, some more challenging statistics, I guess you would say that. And maybe a flashback for David here, too, as we start talking about a recurring nightmare of a story. Traffic deaths continuing to increase in our state. That's coming up on What's Next. And another shout out to our patrons. Please send in your questions. We want to continue with our You Ask, We Answer segment. We do need your questions coming on into Seattle News Views and Brews at gmail.com. Patrons, send in your questions. Make sure we want to hear from you. And David, I do not want to make light at all of the fact that traffic does continue to arise in our state, but this was a story that you were covering several months ago as a transportation reporter for the Seattle Times, and here we go again. Looking at these numbers from the Washington Traffic Safety Commission, we've got statewide 810 people killed in crashes involving a motor vehicle in 2023, up 10% here. This is crazy. And when you think about this, compared to the rest of the country, it's not a good place where Washington is right now, because last year, people dying on U.S. roads, there was actually a 3.6% decrease from the year before, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. So here we are with Idaho and Rhode Island as the three states with some of the most dangerous roads in the country. I just wanted to throw this at you, David, and I know you've reported on this before, but these numbers continue to rise, and I don't know what you make of that.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, I followed it for a while, and you know, there was never any one answer to why.
Right.
Early in the pandemic, the thought was empty roads equaled higher speeds. Mm-hmm. That argument made sense for a little while. It's starting to make less sense because there's a lot of people on the road. It certainly feels like it. You know, we're kind of left with, all right, so what has changed behaviorally or structurally, you know, and so there are a few options. There's bigger cars, but, you know, again, that's a trend that has been happening for a long time. And if you look at the numbers, there is a fairly dramatic spike at 2020. That I don't think can be explained just by larger cars, because again, that's a trend line we've been on for a while. You would think there'd be more direct correlation. And so, you know, the things that stand out still are speed and distraction. And when you look at speed and distraction, it's hard to ignore the fact that tickets enforcement are still quite a bit down. I haven't done enough. I mean, I haven't done any reporting recently, so I don't know if, say, the Washington State Patrol is more depressed than other states. Like, I don't know if it's a slower or if what tickets look like in other states, you know, and it's something that seems to be uniquely American too. I mean, there's been coverage in the New York Times about this, that other countries are not seeing this level of increase. So,
right.
You know, I mean, I think law enforcement at this point is probably the closest correlation. It's not to say it's necessarily the causation, but it is just a little baffling that we saw these increases at the beginning of the pandemic, and B, that they haven't come back down at all, that they've been, in fact, getting worse. So, yeah, it's, and you know, there's lots of systemic explanations for this. Of course, there's older roads are just designed in a way that will kill people. I don't think that entirely explains why the last few years have seen such a huge spike in Washington specifically, except for perhaps, you know, just the fact that there are, you know, you can drive right now pretty recklessly and feel pretty comfortable. You're not going to get a ticket.
Yeah, I've heard that from so many different people. And I get the feeling, too, just in wrapping this thought up, that we're going to hear a lot more about this as the city starts pushing for its transportation levy this fall. Any thoughts there? Because Seattle is, I mean, I guess it's no surprise because we've got the largest population in the state. But this is a city that unfortunately leads the way in terms of these different traffic deaths. And King County, one of the worst areas for these as well. So I guess I'm trying to figure out how locally we're going to see a response to this, because I think the city and county have a lot to speak for here and a lot to answer for when it comes to these traffic deaths.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, you could point to the fact that SPD, the Seattle Police Department, basically does not do traffic enforcement anymore. And so there are an increased number of, you know, automated traffic cameras around the city. And actually the police contract that we just talked about opens the way for civilians to do more review of automated tickets.
That's
so theoretically that could kind of speed that process on along a little bit. You know, the big transportation levy, you know, there would be money, I think, for a place like Aurora. You know, the state has put down $50 million to improve Aurora, but it hasn't gone out yet, partially because they have been waiting for Seattle to come in with kind of some match. I think this transportation levy would provide that match. And, you know, as we know, Aurora is one of the deadliest streets in the city, actually the deadliest street in the city. And so, I think that would probably be fairly significant. And then, you know, just some revisions to some big arterials in the city. But again, you know, it's just really hard to pin down exactly what is causing this spike, you know? So that's not to say there aren't structural improvements that could be made. Just pinning down exactly why the last few years have been so bad has always been a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah, it definitely has been. David, thank you for all this. I do need to wrap up with you here. And I wanted to bring this up. I remember hearing it in Driver's Ed, don't drive angry, calm down, don't drive angry. But it doesn't seem to apply for George Kirby when he pitches for the Mariners. The angrier he gets, the better he pitches. How does that work? That guy's like just channeled fury on the mound there. It's amazing to watch.
Yeah, he's my favorite pitcher. I don't know, just the way I think he has the possibility to be like a Hall of Famer legitimately. He's just so good. You know, it's a long season. I think these dudes need to find motivation wherever they can. And so if anger is that motivation, then good on him.
Yeah, keep it rolling there, Furious George, indeed. Well, thank you, David, as always, for joining me here. Thanks to everybody who's listening to this episode of Seattle News, Views, and Brews, where you can always find out what's brewing in local politics. Thanks especially to our patrons who support the show. If you want to be a patron, find this podcast on Patreon, Seattle News, Views, and Brews. Hear us on Spotify, Apple, wherever you're listening. We are there. And if you do listen, again, please consider becoming a patron, too. Thanks for watching on Converge Media as well. We'll see you next time. Seattle News, Views, and Brews is an independent production of Callinan Media Services. Copyright 2024.